Okay, great. Thank you. Next, we have Eric Salate, who is a researcher with the Climate Impacts Group. Eric, thanks very much.
Okay, I'm going to talk about some recent work we've been doing in the Climate Impacts Group in collaboration with Cliff Masson, a couple of graduate students, Patrick and Rick, in atmospheric sciences. Most of the work we've been talking about in climate change has been based on the global climate models, which give a very good picture from a regional scale of what's happening under climate change. But when we start to get really down into the nitty-gritty details of this and look at the watershed scale and other very fine geographical regions, the question becomes, well, does what the global climate models say on the large scale really apply at very specific locations? And using the modern high-resolution climate models, we can get a better picture of this detailed climate response on the regional scale. So let me first start with the broader picture of what the regional climate models say for the Pacific Northwest, and then tell you how the different fine-scale processes in the region may give a different signal to that. So here we look at Pacific Northwest temperature changes under climate change. These are from the recent IPCC climate model runs that were part of the report that's been released. And we see that from 2000 to 2100, over the next 100 years, there are several climate models that show that provide simulations out over the 100 years. And the solid lines are ones that show an aggressive emission scenario. And the dashed lines are the same models run with a stabilization scenario. And as you look out into the future, 25 years out, there's about a 3/4 of a degree centigrade increase, and then mid-century, about a degree and a half, 1.7, among all these models. And then out at the end of the century, it gets closer to 3 degrees Celsius. And an important thing to notice is that, you know, until mid-century, the emission scenario does not have much effect on climate change. That we pretty much bought in to a certain amount of climate change, irrespective of what we do in terms of mitigation. At the end of the century, though, there's a huge change in the amount of warming we see between the dashed lines for stabilization and the solid lines, which is an aggressive emissions scenario. So as you see too here, this blue box shows the range of natural climate variability from year to year. And we can see that as we get out to the middle of the century, most of the models are showing a warming that brings us the mean warming up out of that range of natural variability. But before that, we still have a warming that's, you know, much of the time we're still within the observed range historically, but a few years we'll be outside the range. By the time we get to the end of the century, though, pretty much all the years are going to be warmer than anything we've seen in the past for some of these more aggressive scenarios. For precipitation, we have a much different picture. First of all, as you know, we have a very large range of natural variability in precipitation for the Pacific Northwest. And the climate change signal, as compared to that, is much more modest as opposed to what we saw in temperature. The models, though, show a very strong consensus towards modest increases in precipitation over the region, particularly in some of these models, which show as much as 6% increases in precipitation as we go out into the future. So when we want to go from this global model picture, which you see here, this is a picture of temperature in January from a global model for the Western Hemisphere, we want to zoom down into the Pacific Northwest and see what does this mean for resources in our region in particular. So as you see in the upper panel here at the global climate model resolution, the features of our region that we are so familiar with are entirely missing. We don't see the colder temperatures associated with the mountain ranges of the Olympics and the Cascades and other features like that. So through a process of downscaling, we add additional information to what the global model has provided us in order to get this local scale information. There's two methods that are used to do this. It's empirical downscaling, where you note certain relationships in the past between the large scale temperature and small scale temperature. For example, it just gets colder as you go up the mountains. So if the climate model is giving you a certain mean temperature over an area, the lowlands will be warmer and the highlands will be cooler. A similar sort of relationship can be made in terms of precipitation. The other method is to use a regional climate model, which is another physical modeling system that attempts to bring into the prediction all of the very fine-scale physical processes, meteorological processes, land surface interactions that affect the regional climate and temperature. So these are just some details on the model, which I can probably skip over, but the important thing is that this is based on the MM5 model, which is used currently for operational weather forecasting in the region. So we have a lot of experience with this model and using the output from this model for resource management in the region. And we'll be running this down to 15-kilometer resolution over the region. And the simulations I'll be showing you will be using the ACCM5, the German global climate model, to force the boundary conditions of the regional model. So it's basically using it to downscale that particular global model, although we use several other global models to do that. So just to give you an idea of what the task is here, this is the topography as represented in a global model with this sort of gentle upslope over the region to the Rocky Mountains, sort of a big coastal plain here, instead of what in fact we have is a valley between the Puget Sound, between the Olympics and coastal mountains and the Cascade Range. I mean, all those important features are missing, the Snake Plain. All the features that are essential to our local climate are missing in the topography, as well as land-water contrast and other things that are important. So I'm just going to go through two examples of the kind of response we see in these regional climate models that I think can inform how we think about climate change in the region. These results are still somewhat preliminary in the sense that they're not necessarily ready for prime time in terms of impacts applications, but the general physical processes that are going on here, I think, are reliable and robust, and I think we will expect to see these sorts of effects, maybe with slightly different magnitudes and regional distributions as we go forward with this. So what is driving precipitation changes that I showed you earlier in these climate models? What we have on our region here on the left is, this is a picture of the current climate for the region. And the blue areas show intense precipitation, and the orangey areas are less precipitation. This line across here indicates the storm track in winter. So this is for the November, December, January, the rainy season for the Northwest. And that storm track is where the centers of those storms, on average, move across the region and bring the rain to our coast. And the blue area shows the intense rain, which sort of falls to the south of that storm track, and then it broadens as those storms encounter the topography of the continent. And in the climate models simulate that current climate distribution very well for the 20th century simulations. Under climate change, what they show is a much more intense storm track that also moves somewhat north, and a huge increase in the spread and intensity of the precipitation on the coast. The contour lines on the top, since it's hard to compare the colors, show the actual difference between these two panels. And you can see that everywhere north of, say, the Bay Area along the coast experiences increases in precipitation, with changes as much as 10 or 15% for Washington and up into southern Alaska. So this is the picture we get from the global models. When we take one of these models and we run it through the mesoscale simulation with MM5 to downscale that, we get this pattern. Now, this is the previous map I showed you was for the whole 50 years, 2050 to 2100, the last 50 years of the next century. This is just a 10-year time slice, so it's a little less smooth than what we would get from a longer simulation. But what we see here is that we do get that increase in precipitation over the region, but that increase is very much concentrated along the windward slopes of the Cascade Mountains, both south and north, and then a greater intensification up into southern, the British Columbia coast. And some decreases in other areas. So to try to sort this out a bit, let's look at what we can do with empirical techniques and try to separate out the various effects. So if I look just at what's coming from the precipitation information in the climate model, and I downscale that using historical relationships between large-scale and small-scale precipitation, I get this map here. Because this is only a 10-year time slice, this inter- and decadal variability, and we don't get the moistening over the whole coast here, and it's mostly concentrated to the north. So the precipitation signal from the climate model is only increasing the precipitation way in the northern part of the region. If I do we know from the past, though, that the circulation patterns over the region have a big effect on how the precipitation is distributed across the mountains, the strength of the rain shadow effect. So when we put precipitation into the empirical model, we get an intensification along the mountains. So what this shows is that the effect that we see in MM5, which is a stronger effect than what we see in this empirical method, but it seems strongly related to the changes in circulation that occur under climate change. So, and also the fact that it's decreasing over Vancouver Island, which is sort of tilted with respect to the mean flow that comes to the west, it's decreasing along that, whereas it's increasing along the north-south ridges, indicates, I think, very nicely the relationship between the circulation patterns and the distribution of precipitation over the region. So what I think this is telling us is that we can expect that circulation changes, patterns of the storms over the region, can have an important influence on how precipitation changes over the region under climate change and how precipitation is distributed across the mountain ranges. The second effect is more warming. I'm halfway through, so it's a good point. This here is a map of the temperature changes from the 1990s to the 2050s in the regional climate model for the Pacific Northwest. And this compares well to what I showed you for the regional mean of about a degree and a half for mid-century. So a degree and a half is this sort of middling red color here. And so the model, the regional pattern, smoothed out more or less is the same as what we're getting from the regional model, but we get localized intensification of the warming along the windward slopes of the mountains and in the high plateaus circling Vancouver Island and other things like that, other areas like that. If we take the difference between the warming in the mesoscale simulation and the warming signal from the global model, we see in these red areas that the mesoscale model is indicating a larger warming signal than the raw climate model, global climate model. The blue areas actually, it shows less warming. So there's a redistribution of warming around the region relative to what the global model says. And the main effect that's driving this is the changes in the snow cover. So on the left is that map of temperature changes I showed previously. And on the right here is a similar map showing where snow cover is lost. So the dark red areas are where you're losing 40 or 50% of the snow cover. So you're going from areas that were previously snow covered in white, reflecting sunlight, to areas that have lost significant snow cover and now absorbing more heat from the sun. And so you have amplified warming in those regions at the margins of the snow line. So all those places that the snow line moves upward experience a greater warming signal than they would have if you don't account for that loss of snow. And that can have feedbacks too, because you're warming the margins of the snow line, which can cause the snow line to recede more quickly. This was just an attempt to convince you that, I have time, I think, 2 minutes. You might be skeptical as to whether the mesoscale model can accurately simulate the relationship between snow and temperature on these timescales and these spatial scales. So, conveniently, this happens every spring. As we go from January to April, snow melts and we get a warming pattern. And if we look at what happens in the mesoscale model for a 1990s simulation of the transition from April to January, we get a pattern of warming that shows similar intensification and the snow loss. So we know that in the model, we have, in the spring transition, the same thing as what we have in the model for the climate change simulation. But the question is, does that happen in the observed state of the atmosphere? So here I've taken station observations for the January to April transition and plotted against the simulated April to January transition. And we get a very strong correlation between the model and the observations, except for a few stations which are sort of valleys and otherwise very high elevation domains like Stehekin. This pattern increases and intensifies as we go step through from the 2020s, 2050s to the 2090s. Again, we see a similar domain mean sort of temperature signal as what we saw from the climate models themselves with these localized intensifications and reductions in the warming signal associated with these feedbacks like the snow, the loss of snow. And I'm running out of time. So let me show you this plot here to summarize the results. I've taken here three stations locations within the climate models, the regional climate model simulation. The black line is the crest of the Cascade Mountains. The blue line is the upwind slopes of the western slopes of the Cascades, upwind. The green line is Columbia Basin. Red is the Snake River Plain, and the purple is the Washington Coast. As you see, the warming signal is very much smaller than the other areas in the region for both the crest of the Cascades, where there's lots of snow now and will continue to be lots of snow in the future as we step from the 1990s through to the end of the century, whereas in the Snake Plain, where you have sort of marginal snow cover and not even consistent snow cover from year to year, you get much greater warming because of that loss of snow cover. And this is this spread from across the region is very similar to the spread that we see among all the collection of climate models that are available. So do models tell the whole story? They give a good picture of the regionally aggregated response, but when it comes to things like circulation effects on the orographic distribution of precipitation, there's some important things that can happen there, and very fine-scale effects like snow albedo feedback, which I showed you also, can lead to localized intensification of warming. So I'm out of time, but I will be happy to take questions.